You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
Good evening, Moadim LeSimcha, Shabbat Shalom. This is Nomi Segal with a look at culture and lifestyle stories. It's Passover this week. In this special holiday interview, Rabbi David Mason, a former community rabbi in London and the current executive director of the social action organization Hayas J Corps, spoke to London correspondent Jerry Lewis about the inward and outward aspects of Passover.
Rabbi David Mason, former community rabbi in two parts of London, now got a new job. More about that later on. But first of all, Pesach, this year, very, very significant because of what's been happening in the Middle East and the anti-Semitism we've seen around the world. Such some reflections from you on the significance of Pesach and how it ties in with what problems we have today.
Thanks, Jerry, so much for having me on. It's really good to be on for my first time here. Great to be with you. So, yeah, on Pesach, there is an inward side and an outward side to Pesach. The inward side, of course, is the suffering that the Jewish people went through in Egypt. And in some ways, we reflect on the fact that in every generation, there are struggles. In every generation, there are people that are out to get the Jewish people. But part of the Passover story is the belief that God is there, in a sense, to protect us from that. Hence, there is still a Jewish community today over so many generations. And so today, this year, we do think about 7th of October. It's very much in our mind. We think about those who won't be celebrating Pesach because they're in captivity and hostage. We think of our brethren, our brothers and sisters in the state of Israel, which is so important to us as a people, and how they will be feeling with the worry of attack from Iran. And of course, after the Hamas attack and the war going on in Gaza. So definitely there is a reflectiveness inward about we will sit together and we will be reflecting together on it being a difficult time for Jewish people at the moment. And that adds here, of course, outside Israel. I don't think it's as difficult, clearly, but it is tricky. It is difficult. We've seen a growth in anti-Semitism. And with that, bit more worried about being Jewish.
The Passover service consists of famously of a meal, but prayers both before and after. Can you give us some ideas of the types of prayers which we have to say?
Yeah, so we have a Seder, and the Seder is an order. And in fact, the meal in some ways is part of that order. So rather than it being prayers, the central thing about Passover is to tell the story of something that happened a long time ago. We are on Passover as a nation, each in our own way, using the Haggadah as a tool to tell the story of the foundation of our nation. And that's big, isn't it, in terms of our identity, that we all on Passover, however religious we are, whichever denomination we are, will in some way connect back to that foundation story of our people. And we do that through a number of readings connected to the Bible. There's lots of layers to the Passover Seder. And we, in a sense, there is a pattern which starts in slavery and ends in freedom. On the night of Passover, through what we do, through the eating of the matzah, the leavened bread, through eating the maror, even the charoset, these are symbols that can both be understood as symbols of slavery, but also symbols of freedom. That's really the sort of trajectory of the Passover night, which ends with Hallel singing praises on our freedom, and of course the songs we love singing at the end as well.
There are many traditions associated with Pesach, Passover, not least of all the Afikoman. What's the significance, especially of the Afikoman, besides for kids?
Yes, exactly. It's always been a kid's thing, and no one really knows what the Afikoman is. The Afikoman, in a way, the second bit of matzah that we eat later as dessert, is meant to represent actually the Passover offering. It's meant to be in place of that. We don't do offerings, we don't have offerings, but in the days of Temple, the Passover offering, obviously, was, from a biblical perspective, really important and central part. And so it was instituted that instead of that, the Passover offering would be eaten actually as dessert. Unbelievably, there was a lot of meat eaten in those days. We eat, instead of that, we eat the afikoman. So it also represents a sense of freedom. And it's the last taste we're meant to have. So even though many would say you don't want matzah to be your last taste, I suppose it's having the taste of freedom on your mouth, which is really important at the Seder. The last drink is meant to be from the four cups of wine, which is also a taste of freedom.
And why four cups?
So four is a big number, yeah. Four is a cracking number, really. And we are, we read in the Bible, reading the Torah, early in the book of Exodus, that there are four languages used for redemption. I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, and I will take you to me as a people. God speaks redemption in four different ways. And the rabbis thought, okay, these are four different levels of freedom, from taking you out of the slavery to saving you to redeeming you from that place, and to then building a relationship around the Torah, according to the religious approach. It's interesting that there is a fifth word there. I will bring you to Israel. And there are opinions, would you believe it, in halakha, in Jewish law, that there is a fifth cup of wine. There is an opinion of a fifth cup of wine.
But is that Elijah's cup?
Well, exactly. Isn't it interesting that because there is an argument as to whether we should drink a fifth cup of wine, there is this idea that Elijah comes to solve all problems. And that, for many, is why it's called Elijah's cup. Because whenever the messianic period comes, or Elijah will come, the idea is that he will decide whether it should be or not, which I quite like. I think that's quite cute.
But Jews don't normally drink excessively, maybe a pouring Simchat Torah, but...
No, and it's very interesting. I think there was a famous rabbi who would have a very quick Seder, have the four cups, go for a shluf, a little sleep, and then come and do the Seder because he felt there was too much wine, because he was the rabbi and he has to decide. So you're right. I suppose they're spread, but it's a good point. It's not, I suppose, excessive, because you're meant to drink a certain amount, and you don't have to go a lot more than that. Some will mix with grape juice, and if they can't tolerate wine, then you can still fulfill it through drinking grape juice. There is just an element of freedom associated with red wine. And red is because, I suppose, of the plague of blood, which is part of the story. So.
I've attended a few seders with friends who are very dutty, from Orthodox, where they have to eat a certain amount of matzah to comply with what rules there were. Yeah. I found it a struggle. Where's the origins of that?
So the origins are in terms of how we understand the measurements. So really, what is an olive's amount? And because of rabbis over history changing the measurements and developing it, it's not like the olive that you see. Some say that, actually. And therefore, it's basically the complicated nature of measurements in Jewish law. And for some, there was a rabbi in Bnei Brak in the middle of the 20th century called the Chazon Ish, who doubled the measurements, and it ends up being a lot more, which will add also to the amount of wine you're meant to drink, and etc. So it is a lot. And then I suppose we get very worried on Pesach about making sure we fulfill. And therefore, you're like, okay, I'll go for the strict one, because whatever happens, that's going to be the right one. And so, yeah, you're right. People end up stuffing their face with matzah on Pesach, and then they don't want to eat it anymore, I suppose.
There's also the Paschal Lamb. What's the relevance of Paschal Lamb? Is it part of the offering of the altar? Or?
Yeah, the Paschal Lamb, you know, for many offerings are difficult, aren't they? But the Paschal Lamb was, in temple times, the central service and part of it. Obviously this goes back to that moment of redemption for the Jewish people. It represents, so we don't do everything that was done on that night when they came out of Egypt. In fact, actually, there are lots of things, like they were told to put their belts on and get ready and put their backpacks on their back. We don't do that. There is, interestingly, a custom I saw where people put buckets of water on the floor, put a backpack with matzah and go through it, just like they went through the Red Sea. And the Sephardi Jews also have some really interesting customs as well, like that. So it's all really about, as much as we can, trying to reenact the Exodus. We can't fully do it. We weren't there. There is a belief that many have that our souls were there. The Jewish people were there in some sort of way. But, you know, we can't fully do it, but we do as much as we can.
Well, I've been to a Sephardi Seder on a few occasions where a spring onion is produced, and during Dayenu, people go round and hit each other.
I can't remember why that is. There is a good reason for that, but that is great fun. I know. I remember someone. Well, yeah, there was a member of my synagogue who used to talk about doing that when he was younger. Yeah,
and of course we have a boiled egg.
Yeah,
and that comes from.
Well, the boiled egg is interesting, actually, because there is this idea, and it's actually real, that the first day of Passover is always the same day of the week as the 9th of Av. And the 9th of Av is a day of mourning, which is interesting. You've got this element of mourning. And think about, actually, what that means for us as people who are mourning what happened on the 7th of October and what we've been hearing since. So probably the egg could take on a lot more resonance for us now. The idea that it's round, which is cycle of life, but the egg is a mourning food. It's a food that's first given to people who sit Shiva, who mourn after losing a close relative. And so it connects between the mourning of Tisha B'Av and Pesach, because they're on the same day. That's how it got in, which is really interesting.
Now, for those listeners who are in Israel, they just have one night of Seder. For us, Chutz La'aretz, abroad, diaspora Jews, we have two. Is there any way around all that?
No, I don't think so. I think, well, we need a strong Sanhedrin and a return of some sort of glory to the, or more unity maybe around the religious life of Israel. So I don't think yet we're anywhere near that. The biggest issue, of course, is for Jews who go to Israel, who are from here. And there are different opinions there. Some will be right, I would do like the place I'm in. And there was a rabbi called the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Ashkenazi, who said that. You do according to the custom. And some say, you know, sorry, it's about where you, you know, it's the stricter approach. So you'll get different approaches. And it's always about who you ask, you know. You ask Lubavitch, Lubavitch will say do one day in Israel. If you live in London or in outside Israel, they will say when you're in Israel for Pesach, do one day. So always ask a Lubavitch if you want the right answer for that one.
In the British community, there's been a recommendation to commemorate, to remember the hostages. What are we supposed to be doing?
So we have the idea, haven't we, of a separate seat, an empty seat for a hostage. And I think that's right. I think, you know, we have a cup for Elijah, don't we? There's something about people coming in. In fact, we at the beginning, actually, of our Seder say, Kol dichvin yete v'yechol, all who are hungry, come and eat. So there is something about those not here. I know people who do a fifth son, talk about the son that, for someone who's special needs. And so there is that. So I think it is very appropriate this year that we do that, that we it allows us to reflect on what we've lost at our Seder.
Now, you've come out of being a rabbi for a community. You still retain your title, obviously. You've taken on a fascinating new job within the community involving the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. We need a little explanation of what they do. And J-Corp, which is looking after refugees, etc. Can you give us some insight onto the work which this will involve?
Absolutely. I think it also connects back to the I talked about the inside bit of Passover. There's the outward-looking bit, isn't there, which is all who are hungry, right? This is the bread, all who are hungry, all is very open. And so even at the same time as we're going to be thinking about ourselves and we worry about anti-Semitism and about the threats to Israel, it's important that, for me, it's important that the Jewish community still realises its important place and responsibility within society. I think the chief rabbi mentions that well. One of his planks was responsibility. And so that's really led me to move on from the rabbinate after a good positive 20 years of being a rabbi of a community to running Hayas J-Corps. And our main aim is to be a Jewish organization that supports refugees. We want to advocate within the sector. So we want to be able to help with policy change, help talk to members of parliament, to politicians, city hall, councillors. So we want to be there doing that work. We want to engage with the Jewish community.
So it's outreach, basically.
Yes, exactly, outreach, but both out in the sector, in the political world, but also within the community. So we're already building quite a lot of relationships with Jewish communities. And we are able to inform them inspire them, and also work on developing volunteer projects so that members of Jewish communities can befriend, support refugees, and also or hold events in their community about issues around refugees, and also in terms of taking on the legacy of J-COR, the anti-racism side, thinking about the racism that refugees often face. People who come here from other places who need our support often find that it's very difficult because, in some way, because of racism. And we want to be at the forefront of allowing our community to stand against that when it can.
And this is not for Jews, this is to help.
Our beneficiaries are not Jewish. Yeah, listen, if a refugee is Jewish, we're not turning them away. But generally today, HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, is over 100 years old. It was based in America, but now is global. 22 countries, supports in a humanitarian way refugees, people who are displaced. So in Chad, there are hundreds of thousands of Sudanese there. In Kenya, they work with Somali. In Colombia, Guatemala, in Europe with Ukrainians. And their idea, HIAS, is that we were helping Jews, so they would help Jews from the Holocaust, pogroms, Soviet Union. But now, as Jews, we're helping others. It's our Jewish values of compassion, of a desire for partnership, of solidarity, that mean that we want to help others as well. And I think that's what we're taking on here, to be that organisation that's our focus, to try and, in a sense, motivate, mobilize Jewish people, community, to help people who need us.
So we're helping other members of other religions as well. You're known for being very positive towards interfaith.
Yeah, and I think that's a part of it. And I think one of the things that we are looking at is where possible to combine with other faiths. So I've actually been building a group of faith leaders to amplify our voice on refugees.
And these are from other faiths? These
from Church of England, Methodism, from the Muslim community. And I think it's also a way where, even given the difficulties we face at the moment, and we always need to be, I think, sensible. We always need to be careful because of the context of Israel and understanding anti-Semitism. So we always have to be careful who we work with. But I think within that, the refugee crisis that we are seeing allows us to build those partnerships.
Now, refugees is a word which is very emotive. We were, if you can call it, refugees from Egypt. Yeah. Today, there are refugees pouring into Britain through from in Africa and the Middle East. America has lots of refugees coming in from Mexico, etc., etc. What's the lesson for Pesach to deal with refugees?
Well, we are told in the Bible and the Torah, you should love the stranger because you were strangers in Egypt. When we were strangers in Egypt, it meant we were treated in a way where we had zero compassion. We had our place. I don't think we were pouring in. And I don't think actually even today the numbers are pouring into our country. Often these politicians make it look like that. But I don't think in terms of the numbers of asylum seekers, if you look as a percentage of the refugees and past that we've had in this country and the general world problem, we're not being flooded with people. You know, there are 100 million or so people in the world who are refugee. Most of them are either internally displaced or in the neighbouring country. So it's a very smaller amount who move. And many have reasons to move because they might have family or because they think Britain's a good place to be. And whatever we do, it probably is a lot better than where they've come from. So for me, we had that lack of compassion. Therefore, if we have people in that situation, we should treat them with compassion too. I accept that every country has borders. And that means that you need security and you need some element of control. I do accept that. So this is not an open border policy. But we don't have an open border. I don't think any party is suggesting that. And I think what we need to do is have a system which is fair, treats people properly and allows the best chance, like we had, to become neighbours. We want to turn the stranger, because we were, into neighbours, people who take their bin out, send their kids to school, contribute to the economy and contribute to society. From our experience, that wasn't always easy, but I think we can do that for others.
Only a large number of Jews flooded into Britain in between the war to World War One and World War Two. Others came even earlier waves of immigration. And they settled in without the problems that modern immigrants have.
And if you remember, not saying if you remember because both of us don't remember, but there was opposition. You know, in the early 20th century with the alien law, right, there was opposition. So it also, you know, we suffered that sense of there's too many invading. Well, I don't think the numbers, I mean, we know from Kinder Transport was, what, 10,000. So we were, you know, others obviously came. But, and there was a serious need then, because those turned away would have been killed. You know, we really had a serious need. So, yeah.
The concept of looking after refugees is in most people's inner feelings, even to welcome a stranger at the table for Pesach. There is a strong view in certain Jewish circles that there's too many immigrants coming in, both in America, they feel it, and there's vociferous groups in America, and even here in Britain, where there are some people who say, Dayenu, enough.
I think the reason that people might feel that is because of the way the system has been worked. If it was done properly, if people's claims were seen quickly, if they were then allowed a chance, if housing stock was better, our health outcomes were better, whatever, I think that we would less feel the problem. We are a country of immigration. I mean, if you look, that's, you know, going back to, you know, Indian, Pakistani, Windrush. We are, in a sense, layers of immigration. And people who become part of this country and who want to, in their way, feel British. And so I think if we have a system, and I want a government to do that, which is which allows the asylum claim, which treats it fairly. And so, yes, some might have to return, that's fine. Which allows good outcomes for people, which works with councils, which works with civil society, we would, I think, we would feel it less. In other ways, we need a better social contract in this country. And at the moment, I feel there's more division than togetherness. I think that togetherness would probably allay a lot of fears.
Do you have many fellow travellers amongst your rabbinical colleagues?
I think, listen, I'm now working, in a sense, in this position across the community. So across the denominations, there are quite a few, you know, rabbis and leaders who agree with this. And I think it's also a function of how much time people will put into Israel. And at the moment, that's a big issue for many people. And so there might be less bandwidth for this. But I think if you find the right project, program, idea, they will. I think this is less controversial than people actually feel. If this means befriending someone locally, building a group of people in a community who can support a local family, it could be telephoning, it could be collection, it could be having events. There are ways in which a community can do something which I think are all right, and we can work with them. And we want to be an organisation that works with local communities to help them.
And the organisation has supported those Jewish families who've taken in Ukrainian refugees.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't worked directly with them. So that's, and World Jewish Relief have been doing some work on that and do great work, obviously. But we, obviously, I think that's amazing. And that's been the reaction of the community to that has been incredible. There are difficulties with that programme because it was 6 months. For some, they've kept going. For others, it's giving difficulty for the Ukrainian who then has nowhere to go.
But that's a government decision to make it 6 months.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to come draw this to a conclusion, there are two areas I wanted to ask you about. There are some Jews going around the community saying, we're not very happy with Israel and what's happening in Israel at the moment. It's not that we're not in favour of Israel defending itself, but some are maintaining the way it's doing it is causing waves and anti-Semitism. What message have you got for them?
I think, look, I think that's not our area of work. I think what we would say is, you know, clearly that there are certain things above the politics. I think for us, it's important that there is a state of Israel, which is inclusive, democratic. It's important for us that there is a Palestinian state, or there should be a Palestinian state. And I think with that, we would want an end to the conflict through a political process. And I think for us as a humanitarian organisation as well, we definitely worry about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. So I'm not looking at our organisation to be a political organisation in terms of political Zionism that's situated somewhere. There are other organisations that can do that. I think we do still need to accept that the state of Israel is very important for the Jewish community, for Jewish identity. It's incontrovertible that that's the case. But I do think that there will be more and more people who will find criticism. And I think there will be fault lines also between Israel and the diaspora. So if you don't mind me saying, one of the things that I found difficult today, I think, was the giving of an award by the president of Israel to Douglas Murray. And I think personally, and we would find him someone who, yes, might be very pro-Israel and pro-Jewish, but at the same time is quite extreme in his relationship with Islam and is problematic with that. And that just creates a sort of a shaking of the relationship, which I think we need to think about as a community.
And the final question, not unrelated to the Douglas Murray, things have changed drastically since the 7th of October for people who are working in the interfaith field, trying to bring together Muslims and Jews. Has it affected your work? What do you advise communities to do?
I think when I was a rabbi, I set up the multi-faith network in Haringey. And one of the key elements to it was that it was a very much strong part of civic society, that we were bringing faith leaders together in order to create social cohesion. So I think there's certainly a lesson for interfaith. If interfaith is simply about interfaith conversation, then my worry is it won't go deep. But if interfaith relationship is about building social cohesion, however bumpy, right? And it could be that it's private and not public sometimes. It will be conflict resolution based sometimes. It could be open and robust, showing where fences, where the lines should be. Then I think we all should be hopeful that there will be communities that can build relationships to each other. And so maybe we should look a little bit beyond interfaith to the world of social cohesion.
You studied conflict resolution.
I studied it in King's College, conflict resolution in Divinity Society. My members of my synagogue used to say, oh, wow, you'll be great at conflict. And I used to say, well, I'll help with Rwanda, maybe. I'm not sure with the shul, which I was joking. But
there's the same balance Israel between different sectors of the Jewish community with each other and also with the Palestinians.
I think we're going to extremes. I think what's happened, I mean, Hamas are very clever, aren't they? And this is probably what they wanted, is that it pushes people to the extremes. It's like, in some ways, I would say that what happened on the 7th of October was our 9/11. I'm not sure about the Holocaust. I mean, obviously, it was the largest number, but I wouldn't compare it to the Holocaust, simply because we have a state. We didn't then. We could, you know, and we made big mistakes to allow it ourselves in neglecting the border, but we could just shore up the border and we now go in, right? But I would say it's our 9/11. And that has obviously big effects, on the state, you know. So, yeah.
Well, it's been a fascinating discourse. And Rabbi David Mason, I'm very, very grateful to you.
Jerry.
And can I wish you hatzlacha?
Thank you very much.
Chag Sameach.
Have a lovely chag, and it's been great being on. Thank you, Jerry.
Rabbi David Mason. Here's Yoni Genut, Bitzet Yisrael.
בצאת ישראל ממצרים, בית יעקב מעם לועס, הייתה יהודה לקודשו ישראל, ממשל אותה הים רעה וינוס, הירדן תיסוב לאחור, הערים רקדו חילים, גבעות כבני צור, מלפני
A dedication ceremony was recently held for the new fortified dialysis unit at Schneider Children's Hospital in Petah Tikva. Developed with a gift of $1.4 million from the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews and named in memory of the fellowship's founder, Rabbi Yechiel Eckstein, the new unit is housed in the hospital's glass building. It is made up of 11 patient stations and two isolation rooms, with reinforced construction that can absorb direct strikes. We heard more from Yael Eckstein, President and CEO of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. So we are speaking following the dedication ceremony of a new fortified dialysis unit at the Schneider Children's Hospital that the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews was involved with. Tell us a little bit about this new facility.
Wow. Well, it was an emotional event, I have to say. I met this gorgeous three-year-old girl named Abigail, who's from Ashkelon. And her mother was telling me that when she was in the middle of getting dialysis on October 7th, they couldn't disconnect her. And her mother was literally covering her with her body as there were rockets falling everywhere. I never thought that there would be a need in Israel to urgently move children on dialysis to a protected area. But we saw on October 7th that that is our reality and we have to be prepared. So it was incredible to see how the donation, $1.5 million donation that the fellowship gave to the Schneider's dialysis unit in the new building is ready, is being used, and at this very moment during this very terrifying war is saving lives like three-year-old Abigail.
Now, certainly fortification of facilities in Israeli medical centers is something that has been an issue known all along. Is this an initiative that was a response to the war, or this was a project that was underway already or perhaps got a push as a result of the developments?
Well, we started fortification of hospitals actually after the Second Lebanon War in 2006, when we saw our home front has to be protected and our hospitals have to be ready for any scenario. So the first donation that we gave was to Rambam Hospital, where they have the ability to move their entire hospital underground. Since then, we've given over $40 million to fortification at different hospitals, like Afula Hospital Ha'emek, where they could move their ICU unit and emergency command center underground, Hadassah, Shari Tzedek, Barzilai. There's a need for these hospitals. Even if the whole hospital can't move underground, the key units, like in Barzilai, the labor and delivery unit and the NICU unit, places where you can't easily move these people in a minute and a half, if you're lucky, that you have between when the siren goes off, when the rocket lands. So the fellowship is really focused on those areas, fortification of emergency units in hospitals that you can't easily move the patients during a code red siren.
Can you tell us a little bit about the setup of this new dialysis unit at Schneider?
Yeah, well, we first walked past the old setup in the old building, and actually it's now being used as an emergency room, and there are lots of windows and glass, and so those are all filled with sandbags. And so before they moved into this new unit, they were in an older unit that was both much, much smaller, I think a fourth of the physical space of what the unit is, and they were surrounded by sandbags with shrapnel falling on October 7th. As we know, Petah Tikva and the entire central area of Israel was very much targeted with rockets, especially during those first weeks of war. So when you walk into the new unit, in contrast to that older unit that was small and covered in sandbags, you walk through very big fortified doors. So you have two sets of doors that are huge bomb shelter doors made of very, very heavy metal that right now are open. But you can see that during times of higher risk, they're closed, and the whole unit, which is around 300 meters, transforms into a full shelter. So you have also windows there. So you have natural light, you have the ability to look outside, but you have those bomb shelter steel windows that you close when there are attacks. So on one hand, it feels like a brand new, gorgeous unit. You have children at every single stand. When I was there yesterday, there were around 15 children getting their dialysis. And it just feels like a beautiful new space that is clean, that's open, that's bright. There was a hospital doctor who's also dressed up as a clown. They're a medical clown, as we have in hospitals across Israel, that there was such a festive, happy energy going around, that everyone was laughing. And there were teachers who were teaching the kids. And the children, despite their medical difficulties, were happy functioning children. But what I heard is that before they were in this protected area, they were actually terrified children that were scared at any moment there would be a code red siren and they wouldn't be able to leave to shelter. So for me, seeing the smiles, seeing the ease, seeing the continuity of life despite the war was the biggest reward there possibly could be.
In addition to this work, this important work fortifying hospitals, how has the activities or projects of the organization been shaped by the war?
Well, Naomi, it's a great question, because I would say at the fellowship, we're really fighting two fronts. One front is fighting anti-Semitism, and our answer is to just engage and educate specifically the Christian community, the pro-Israel Christian community across the world, to be able to know what's happening and to be able to stand with Israel. So estimates are that there are around 700 million evangelical Christians around the world, that in many ways the foundation of their faith is standing with Israel. And so the fellowship's on the forefront of engaging them and making sure we continue to have their friendship and support, with something which is historic. And then the second front is making sure that the people on the ground in Israel are provided for and cared for. So we've already distributed over $50 million of aid in Israel. We've built over 150 shelters. We've placed bulletproof ambulances across Israel. We have distributed over 5,500 bulletproof vests and helmets to first responders. And that's on top of the tens of thousands of meals that we've distributed to elderly and children, the evacuees, the families of the kidnapped. So wherever we identify a need, we create programs to meet those needs, give the people hope, and just make sure at least here on the home front, we're protected, we're strong, and the message intercept, because as we give the aid, it's not only giving the aid and giving the shelters and giving the food, but it's letting people here in Israel know that it's donated specifically from Christians around the world who are saying, "You're not alone," which is so comforting to hear during these days of anti-Semitism everywhere.
Yael Eckstein, President and CEO of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. Here's Ehud Banai, Ha'aviv Befetach. Spring is coming. Finally, the more than 6 months since the October 7th massacre by Hamas has seen a huge increase in people seeking help for trauma. One of the organizations offering support is Natal, the Israeli Trauma and Resiliency Center. Reporter Aryeh O'Sullivan spoke with Yifat Morad, head of international relations and development at Natal, about the organization's work.
Natal is a 26-year-old organization. It's an NGO, a totally apolitical organization that was established to give an answer for all those who suffer from symptoms or from PTSD, what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, due to terror and war and horrible event. For the past 26 years, we've been always there in an emergency event and taking care of the people during the emergency, but also many, many days, months, and years after the event. When the event started on the 7th of October and the war, we were there as usual. We thought it started with missile attacks. So immediately our helpline, which always ready 24/7, with two volunteers, very sleepy volunteers on a Shabbat morning, a holiday, a very, very relaxed day. And we understood that there is a missile attack. So immediately we call upon a few more volunteers and open and switch to what we call emergency mode, which means that they put the helpline number on television, on all the main channels, and we have more volunteers answering the line.
We've been into the war now 6 months. And who are the? How can you give us the makeup of the people who are coming to get services with you?
Right now, we are dealing with, I think we can say, three big groups of people who turn to Natal. Of course, there are the people who were living in the area in the south. We're talking about the festivals, you know, Nova Festival, and the parties that were going on over there. And we're talking about the people who were displaced. And right now, we're talking also about the veterans coming back from a deployment and facing the hardship of going back to routine when the next summon to come back to duty and come back to the military is in the horizon.
Really?
So we are talking about right now with a lot of thousands of people. All of them are citizens, but from different kind of origin that went through the hardship of this war.
Today in the Knesset, there was some testimony from people who were survivors of the Nova, and they said something very interesting. They said that there's been a large number of people who were survivors who committed suicide, over 50 people. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, so you saw the Nova Festival, you know, there were more than 4,000 people. at that festival. And what they had to go through is the worst thing ever. Mm-hmm. There are many, many people who are helping right now to the Nova Festival survivors. One of them is Natal. So Natal was nominated by a group of, you know, government of some offices of the government and Mifala Pais and other organizations to come and give a service that give a few kind of services. One is giving therapy. Another one is giving all kind of intervention like yoga, like art therapy, all kind of things that they can get. Yes, mm-hmm. We understand that the more you get the more you get into the past days and the passing months.
Yes.
And not bringing back the hostage, the burden on the mental burden on the survivor is very, very heavy. I never received the data that you're talking about from the official. We are treating at the moment more than 600 people from the Nova Festival. And we hope, and we do hope, and I'm saying that whoever needs help and needs to speak to somebody and needs to give one-on-one therapy, he should seek it. We are in a race now to reach as many people as we can. And not only Natal, by the way. Natal is not doing it alone. There are many, many organizations that give this assistance. It's really crucial to be there for those people as fast as possible.
Now, I want to ask you about the veterans. Yeah. Israel's 75 years old, 76 years old, and we've gone through lots of wars, and maybe PTSD wasn't aware in previous generations, but it seems that this group of veterans particularly have a high number of people who are seeking help.
Yes, well, we're talking now about a very different generation. Natal was established because of the Yom Kippur War, which was a horrible event in the life of Israeli state. Back then, you know, they tried to hide the post-trauma and not talk about it.
Right.
If people turned with symptoms like a nightmare, couldn't go back to work, had problems within the relationship in the family, and all kinds of symptoms that they suffered, they told them, you know, go to rest, come back, you'll be fine. Nobody gave it a room. But now it's a different time, you know. Right now, there is a different generation that wants to speak about things. They understand trauma. Mm-hmm. They understand what they need to do, and they're reaching much faster to seek help, and still the shame and the withdrawal and the hiding is still there. And that's what Natal is, why we are putting a lot of effort to raise awareness, not only for the people who went through it, but also to all their family, the spouses, their children, their parents. They need to be very alert with the symptoms. And that's why it's so important to reach out and get help, either for the helpline or afterwards with different kind of activities, and not, you know, to Natal or other places. The faster you reach and you get help, the better chance that you will not develop.
But I want to ask you about the payment. Is this a free service? Is it subsidized?
So since Natal is an NGO, and we are most of the budget of Natal is until the 7th of October was more than 70% from donation. So yes, most of the services of Natal is totally free. People who reach out and get the help through the helpline don't pay anything. If they get to therapy, they pay a commitment fee of something like 30 shekels, and those who cannot pay it do not pay that also. So, you know, most of the services of Natal is totally free. They just need to seek help and they will get it.
That's fantastic. It seems that you're getting a good look at the slice of Israel that reveals just how sensitive we are. Are we in a national survival mode?
We are in a national survival mode right now. We are a state that need to, we are still on the survival mode, but we also getting into what we call a surviving routine. Now, to be alert all the time, that takes a very heavy toll of all of us. And there is very, very, it's crucial that people will treat themselves, help themselves, and also try to get to some kind of routine. So when we'll get to the next stage of going back to work, bringing up our families, we'll have, our children, a generation that seeks hope, that want to have peace, and still see things in an optimistic way. Yeah, it's a nation that needs treatment. It's a nation that needs to do a lot of intervention. Not necessarily, you know, clinical treatment, but definitely need to be aware to help ourselves emotionally.
It's the fact that Israel's prepared for treating citizens with organizations like Natal. a sign of resilience? And how would you compare it with the other countries?
Well, we just went through a miracle event, a shocking event, whatever you call it, this Saturday night.
Right.
I mean, thousands of missiles were, you know, launched by from Iran. And if you're looking at the people, and after going through a very dramatic night, they went in the morning. They woke up in the morning. Most of the people went back to their routine. They, you know, treat their children. They went back to work. Everybody went back to shop.
Mm-hmm.
People are doing what they are used to do. And this is resiliency. This is a very, and this is something that you invest in for many, many years. But still, the toll is there. The aggression, the high alert, the depression, okay? All the things that we see around, it comes with a heavy toll. Yes, we are resilient, mm-hmm. but we need to work on it. It's not something that you do from one day to another. It's something that you invest in it for years. We always say in Natal that we work around the clock in three times mode. We help during emergency. We help after something happened. But 50% of our time, we prepare communities to what's going to come.
Mm-hmm.
The more you know about what's going to come, the better you act when it's coming. And I don't think most of the states around us are doing that. We had to do that because it's a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
We are going from one cycle to another. So we are used to prepare. If we know that when people go through some kind of, you know, sirens or an attack, they're going through the three F's, you know, fight, fly, or freeze, they know how they act and they know how to work on it. So they won't freeze when there is a silence, and they won't, and they will go immediately to help themselves. But this is something that you need to educate the people from childhood, from kindergarten, from schools, from the family, the military. You need to do it with everyone. So, yes, I think a lot of states needs to go through it. And this is something that we share, by the way.
Oh, really?
With a lot of communities in the world, yes. Mm. With our friends in Germany, in England, in the States.
Interesting.
Unfortunately, we have to.
That's fantastic. Can you finally just maybe give us some details if someone wants to get in touch with Natal, how they can find it?
So, yes, I think the best thing is to call our helpline, which is the toll-free helpline. And from there, it's just the open gate for lots of services. So it's 1-800-363-363.
Okay, thanks so much for talking to Khan English.
Thank you, and take care.
Okay.
All of you.
Yifat Morad of Natal. That concludes our program. Thanks for listening. You can find Khan English on the Khan radio and digital platforms. This is Nomi Segal wishing you good evening and Shabbat Shalom. Here's Yuval Dayan, Tish'al et Hamayim, Ask the Water.
אז אני כל כך פחדתי לשבור את כל מה שגם ככה לא בא אליי שלם אמרת לי רק תניחי עליי כמו ילד בגשם ראשון אתה חיכית כמה לטיפותיי שיבחרו רק בך תשאל את המים כמה הייתי שקופה זה כואב לי לכאוב את לחתך והרגליים מבקשות מנוחה הלכתי מספיק בשבילך כמעט שנה כולם דעכו בצלחה אז איך בתוך כל המקום שנתתי לך מצאת פינה